I'm the one who lost your location. You didn't.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It is 5:36. Welcome to February 20th, 2024 CPAR meeting. Let's officially call this meeting to order, please.
I'm Italo. Annabelle Nunez.
Present.
Keith Kelvin.
Present.
William Bridges is present. And Martha Lynn.
Here. Great. So item number two, approval of the legal action report and minutes from our January 16th, 2024 meeting. Did you all have an opportunity to take a look at those meeting minutes and the LAR that was sent to us? Would anyone like to make a motion to approve?
I move to approve
minutes on January 16th.
Second.
Okay. Annabelle Nunez?
Aye.
Keith Calhoun?
Aye.
And Martha Lynn?
Aye. Thank you. Okay, so item number three, use of force. Look forward to the presentation. I have some extra handouts if anyone needs them, but it looks like they will give the handouts. And so looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thank you for allowing me to talk to you about our use of force investigation. I'm taking about a two-hour training that we provide to supervisors and condensing it down in 10 minutes. So I'm going to try to hit all the main important topics. But if you have any questions, feel free to ask. That's why I sent the GOs the general orders for this to the clerk's office in advance. So most of what I'm going to speak about is covered under our general order section 2000, which is our use of force. I'm going to give you a kind of a brief high-level overview of use of force because you're going to need that to know what type of use of force is classified as for us to discuss what the investigation is about. So use of force is split up in these general orders under section 2042, which is the levels of force and control. So the first level of force and control, officer presence, that's simply me or an officer being somewhere, how I carry myself, how I, you know, am I standing, am I alert, am I watching my surroundings, am I standing in such a way to appear authoritative? You know, it's simple as the FI stance, the field interview stance that we have with people. My gun is away from the person I'm speaking to. I'm canted a little bit at a 45 degree, enough area to give a reaction time if somebody tries to attack me that I can then react to that. Next is verbal direction. That's going to be giving commands. That can go from as far as, you know, sir, will you please sit down, to me raising my voice and giving commands, sit down right now, or I will take some sort of action if you don't do that. So verbal direction can go anywhere from there. Then we go to empty hand control, which is split up into two categories, soft and hard. Soft empty hand control is things meant to not create any sort of injury other than maybe some temporary redness or pain. That would be control holds, some pressure point pain compliance, the correct OCCS grip when I'm grabbing somebody to put them in handcuffs. That's a soft empty hand control. A hard empty hand control is now stepping up to the next level. That's going to be strikes, elbows, knees, any hits like that. That's going to rise up to the level of hard empty hand control, which could create some sort of injury. Next is our intermediate weapons, which we split up into a lot of areas. We have our OC spray, which all officers are required to carry. We have a baton, which all officers are required to carry. We have our CEWs, which we use a taser. A lot of people refer to CEWs just as tasers. Taser is the brand that we use, but CEW is the type of weapon. That is meant to try to do neuromuscular incapacitation, to incapacitate somebody, to allow us to then detain them. Only people of the rank sergeant and below are required to carry those, which like, you won't see one on my belts today. And then we have some different less lethal munitions. We have our beanbag shotgun, which we don't use anymore, but that was used for a while. We don't use that as much. We have our pepperball launcher, which is basically a paintball gun that shoots pepperballs. There are paintballs that are a little bit thicker that then hit with some, so you get a little bit of paint when it hits, but then they disperse and they have a cloud of pepper that comes out. You can use those directly at people, or we can use them to saturate an area to try to convince people to leave the area, or pre-saturate an area to try to prevent people from going to an area. And then we also have our other chemical agents, and we have a 40 millimeter, which shoots a 40 tip projectile, used again as an impact weapon. And then we have our deadly force, which is, it's a lot of people, when they think deadly force, they think just firearms. There's other ways that officers might use deadly force too. It might be, for example, a vehicle. Hitting somebody with a vehicle is deadly force. There's areas where that can be articulated and justified. So it's not just that. There's other things. Deadly force, specifically in our general orders, chokehold is prohibited unless deadly force is authorized already. Unless you can articulate deadly force, then the chokehold would be prohibited. And then there's other things. Hitting somebody in the head with a baton could be considered deadly force. So those are how we break down our general orders to then discuss how we do our use of force investigations. So, again, in our general, yes?
What is the use of the spitzhack is prohibited?
The spitzhack is something that we used to have. The fire department still used it in hospitals. It was the sock that went over somebody's head to prevent the bleeding. There was a case in New York, I think it was, where a gentleman, the spitzhack was applied to him. He later ended up dying. So our agency decided to stop using the spitzhack. We changed to a different brand that's designed a little bit differently.
Okay.
Called the BioGuard.
Okay.
So we do still have a tool that we can use to apply to prevent somebody from being able to spit on officers. It's just the spitzhack itself, the brand, we stopped using.
Okay, thank you.
And the beanbag, you don't use it because all the other ones just work like this.
I think when I was at the academy, we were phasing it out. I don't think it's still phased out all the way. It's more of the Remington 870 platform trying to maintain it. The 40 millimeter, we were testing switching to that because the 40 millimeter has a better use range. You can use it closer. The minimum standoff is 5 feet. The minimum standoff on the beanbag shotgun is 20 feet because of the potential of overpenetration if you hit somebody when you're too close. So then as you get to, again, outlined in our general orders, there is the use of force reporting requirements investigation starting at 27 in the general orders. Also, it's a little bit difficult to use in the general orders. In there, 2080 is the chart that shows our use of force investigations and how they're split up. And then I also included a use of force flow chart, cheat sheet that we provide our supervisors to make their job a little bit easier in the field when they're trying to see what's required. So as we start with type zero use of force, again, that's the physical interaction meant to control somebody but cause little to no pain other than temporary redness. If that's done, there's no routine that's required. The officer is required to document that in the case report, which is then reviewed by the supervisor when they approve the case report to make sure that everything's covered. So that would be like a push, not including an impact push. An impact push is going to be that double-handed push that I do to somebody's chest usually to create distance. Obviously creates a lot of potential for them to trip as they're rolling backwards and then fall, create injury. So this would just be kind of like if I'm moving somebody out of the way, grabbing again wrists. So the officer is required to document that in their case report, where then it's then reviewed by their supervisor. The use of a BioGuard also is a type zero because we just want to track those uses. Type one is a show of force. So that's a threatened use of force that doesn't result in me having to use the force. That can be as simple as pointing a firearm at somebody, pointing a CW at somebody, pointing a pepper ball or a beanbag shotgun. Anytime one of those weapon systems are pointed at a person, then a type one use of force is completed. Now that doesn't mean every time an officer draws their gun, that report is completed, because there are several instances where an officer might draw their gun but not point it at somebody. But this is pointed at them. So then we have to do that report. That requires notification to the supervisor from the officer that they pointed a weapon system at somebody. They then complete their case report. The supervisor reviews the case report and then does some documentation showing that it's been reviewed, and then usually copies and pastes some of the four shooters' own words from the case report into the food team, and then it is submitted and reviewed and documented that way. So that's reviewed by a supervisor. Also, the use of a wrap restraint, which I know was demoed to the board before, anytime we use the wrap, that is also documented as a type 1 use of force, so we can track the uses of the wrap and make sure that it's being properly applied, and also see the success that we're getting from that tool's way of catching up. Type 2 use of force is going to be hard, empty hand tactics or the use of intermediate weapons that don't result in any significant injury. So, and this can be any claim of injury too. So if we use an armbar on somebody and they say, I think you really hurt my shoulder, now that's all of a sudden going to become a type 2 use of force. Any abrasions, like significant abrasions, we'll get people that we wrestle with on the ground, and then their face is cut and they're bleeding from their face. Now all of a sudden it's a type 2 use of force. We handle it that way. A type 2 use of force requires a supervisor to respond out to the scene. The supervisor is going to speak to the officer that used, or officers that used force, get their side of the story. They're going to review body-worn camera footage. They're going to look for third-party video, security video, anybody who might have been recording, anybody who stopped by. They're going to interview the subject, but that depends on if the subject is willing to give an interview, because a lot of times that investigation might also be where now the subject is a suspect of resisting arrest or aggravated assault on a peace officer. We have to be mindful of their Fifth Amendment rights. So if they read their rights and they refuse to answer questions, we're not going to get their side of the story from what happened before that, because their rights, as far as that considered, are more important than us compelling them to tell us their side of the story. We're going to take photos of any injuries of officers, photos of any injuries of the suspect, and then it's going to be written up by the supervisor, and it requires two levels of review. So if an officer uses a type 2 use of force, then a sergeant will respond to the scene, conduct that, write up their investigation, and then send that investigation to the lieutenant. The lieutenant will then review the entire investigation, watch body-worn camera footage, and then send it off to OPS after that's been completed. If a sergeant uses force, it's going to be reviewed by their lieutenant and their captain before it comes back to OPS. So there's always two levels of review above the member who used force.
And it always goes back to OPS.
It always goes back to OPS, and I'll talk about that. It goes to the force review unit. The force review unit is one detective who's assigned to OPS that does everything like that. We also have type 2 canine. So again, that's where a canine is used that doesn't result in significant injury that would raise it up to a type 3. That's just split out so we can track specific canine uses of force versus non-canine uses of force. So now you get to the type 3 uses of force. This is the use of force resulting in significant injury or with indications of unreasonable or disproportionate uses of force, policy violations, etc. So some of these are really obvious that they're type 3 from the supervisor even response to scene. Somebody's being transported to get stitches. Somebody has a broken bone. The person went unconscious. Things like that. Closed head injuries is another one. So somebody's head is swelling up to the point because they got hit in the head so many times. Those would be obvious to the supervisor. Hey, this is a type 3. The other ones are the supervisor gets out there and they start investigating the use of force, and then they say, something doesn't seem right here. So a type 3 use of force requires everything that a type 2 use of force requires, but it also requires a notification to the OPS lieutenant, which happens to be me right now. So the supervisor on scene gathers all the information, watches body-worn camera video, and then they'll call me. And it's a shall call. It's not you can call or call in a few days. They shall call me, whether it's right now or 3 o'clock in the morning. They will give me a full briefing on it, and after I get the briefing, then I will decide either the team can still handle this, conduct your investigation, and then send it up the chain normally, or put everything on pause. I'm calling out OPS investigators, and now OPS is going to come take over the investigation. Other than that, everything else is the same. Everything else is done. Everything is done from collecting third-party video, trying to interview the subject, everything like that is also done. The other thing to consider when OPS does go out
is now OPS coordinates with the Central Investigation Division because it might be the case now the officer has become the suspect of using excessive force. The other area here, a big one, is any hard control against a handcuffed person. So if we have a person handcuffed and they spit at an officer and an officer responds by hitting them, then that's a type 3 use of force. If we have some other examples, we have suspects who are handcuffed, they're kicking at officers, the officers are trying to get them in the car, so then an officer just takes them down to the ground. Well, now that's a hard takedown of a handcuffed person. It automatically becomes a type 3 use of force. OPS gets called to see for that investigation. And that's one where, that's again where we consider, because technically assaulting, so a non-justified use of force, assaulting a restrained person turns that into an aggravated assault, just like if anybody in the public assaults a restrained person, it's an aggravated assault. So then, if that were the case in that one, and we think that there are potential criminal charges against the officer, then CID comes out and conducts a parallel but separate criminal investigation into the incident, where the officer is a suspect. Type 3 canine are canine bites, again, same, handled the same way as a type 3, but it's canine bites of an unintended subject. So we send the dog running after somebody, somebody else pops out, and that person gets bit instead of the person who sent the dog. OPS would be notified on that. Any canine bite to the head, neck, or groin, or any canine bite resulting in significant injury, so lots of sutures, or it's going to require surgery to fix. Again, I get notified on those to then decide whether the sergeant on scene will investigate it, and up in the chain, or OPS will investigate it. And then the type 4 use of force is deadly force. So on a type 4 use of force, OPS always goes out to those. Additionally, depending on what it is, either the Pima Regional Critical Incident Team responds, or our own members respond. For example, let's say it's a random vehicle that might not automatically trigger a Pima Regional response. We might investigate it, or the HCC can decide to have Pima Regional respond to ask them to respond after that. So discharge of a firearm, deliberate use of a vehicle in a deadly force encounter, and have weapons strikes to the head, use of a chokehold, or any use of force resulting in death. So what would be the investigation death? OPS would respond out and conduct the administrative investigation in that. Additionally, on top of the review being done by the chain of command, randomly every month, OPS grabs 5 completed use of force. It's grabbed by the detective who's assigned in our use of force review unit, and then he assigns those out to 5 OPS investigators. And then the OPS investigator reviews the use of force investigation done by the chain of command. So they look and make sure everything was done correctly, all the correct people were spoken to, the correct evidence was gathered, and that the correct, that they agree with the finding that the chain came to. That can result in either 3 things. It can result in an OPS saying everything that the chain did meets the requirements set out by policy. It could result in it getting sent back to just answer a couple questions. You know, maybe the chain said a member was spoken to about a better way to handle this in the future, but they don't say specifically what, which we want documented to make sure that the next time the member encounters that, to say a year later, the member has the same use of force. Now their commander is different, so their commander doesn't know what they were talked about before to know, did they improve, did they follow and respond to training, or are they still having the same issue? So we might send it back and say, can you just give us a little bit more documentation on this? Or the third option, which we haven't done for the time that I've been in OPS, is we can send it back to the chain and say, this is getting reopened and needs to be reinvestigated. You really messed some things in this one, and you need to reinvestigate it. So that mechanism is in there for us to basically spot check. We're not looking for, did the members do anything bad that that needs to be investigated. We're looking at, did the chain of command do the appropriate investigation of the use of force? Yes.
Do officers that respond to incidents have to progress on their types of force, or can you officers like jump in until after however long it takes to evaluate, you know what, this is type 3? Or do they have to...
So the officers, when they're responding to a scene, aren't thinking of use of force as far as this goes. And the force model that I discussed, they don't have to progress through that. So I don't have to show up at a scene and start with verbal commands and then move to the next one. If I show up at a scene and I see a deadly threat, I can immediately respond with deadly force. But the officers, other than when the reports are done, they're not thinking as far as, is this a type 1, 2, 3? This is more of a tool for the supervisor responding of how is this classified and what steps do I need to take to investigate it.
And it's really that they have to be prepared to respond as to why they chose that particular method to address that situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. So they have to be able to articulate why one of the elements of force is preclusion. So I have to either be able to say, I precluded. So say I get in a fight with somebody and I start with hard empty hand control and I deliver some punches and then I reassess and I say these punches are having no effect. I'm moving up to pepper spray. So then I move and I spray pepper spray. It works. They're detained. So I was able to move up to pepper spray because my punches are having no effect. But in the same way, I can say based on my training and experience, right? So say it's somebody that greatly outsizes me and I'm far enough away where I say, I don't want to get in a hand-to-hand fight with this person. I'm going to go straight to taser, try to get the neuromuscular incapacitation, so then I can detain them while they're under the power of the taser, and to prevent injury to myself and injury to them in a prolonged fight. I can say, based on my training and experience, I went straight to that tool because I was able to preclude these other uses of force as either being ineffective, or this one was the one that was most likely to end the use of force with least risk of injury to myself and the member of the
public. Circling back to what you're saying about officers could face criminal charges for assault.
Yes.
When was the last time an officer had a charge of assault?
So there was a case in 2021. So there's been a couple. There was a case, and I don't remember the years of these. There was a case where an officer was delivering strikes to somebody and kept delivering strikes after they were able to be detained. That officer was disciplined and terminated. I don't know if he faced charges of assault.
Yeah, that was my case. We terminated him, and I believe in that situation it was determined that there wasn't enough probable cause to go with a criminal charge. It was investigated criminally, and they didn't determine there was enough to go with a criminal charge. And it's a lot tougher to prove a criminal charge than it is for a use of force violation. You need preponderance of the evidence, either more likely than not. For a criminal, you got to beyond a reasonable doubt that they committed that crime.
And there will be times where, and probable cause is even less than beyond a reasonable doubt. So there will be times where we will say that there was probable cause to effect an arrest or to present the case to the county attorneys to say, hey, this is what we have. Probable cause is would a reasonable person believe more likely than not that a crime had been, was being, or is being committed. But then the county attorney is going to look at it and say, I have enough to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they say no, then they might not even take the case as trials. But all we need to take disciplinary action, like the captain said, is there a preponderance of the evidence, 51%, that this member committed this violation. There was another case where a member, I don't know probably brushed by a handcuffed person on the ground, like, brushed by their face and in the nose with their foot. That member was terminated. I think he was arrested, but then the county attorney did not issue charges. And then in the case with Officer Remington that recently went through, that one, the agency terminated him. It's now gone through civil service upheld determination. That one is still the county attorney has gone through two grand juries, and they're still talking about a possible third grand jury.
Wow.
So there have been some cases. And then we have had some where the member, where we had one where criminal did come in, criminal looked at it, and they said, we don't think that this is criminal, but they still took it to the county attorney, and then the county attorney agreed, said, yep, not criminal. They took the investigation and said, we don't. And that happens with every officer-involved shooting, too. So every officer-involved shooting is presented, the investigating agency from the criminal side takes their investigation, presents it to the county attorney, and then the county attorney either says, we're going to issue charges and take this to grand jury, or they issue what's called a letter of decision, in which they say they reviewed the case, and based on the facts that were presented to them, they find that the officers are justified in using the force that they used.
There's justifications in the statutes for uses of force, for the use of deadly force, and those are the things that criminal has to take into account, and generally why the case is presented to a county attorney first before an arrest is made, just to see what do we have here, because it's a real different world than that happened in the society.
So it doesn't happen often.
Not often, well, fortunately.
I'll throw out there, he also sends us a monthly report to all the captains, and it lists every use of force of every officer in my division, and it breaks it down by squad so that I can easily look for trends. So even though the uses of force are justified, there might be, if all of a sudden I see, you know, oh, squad 3 all of a sudden has gone from an average of 2 uses of force a week to 5, and they got a new sergeant, then maybe we've got a supervisory issue that we need to address for some more oversight, or if one officer starts seeing an increase, so then we can look at the long-term trend and intervene before something becomes a problem.
These stats are kept and are available through the use of force dashboard to the public.
I don't think the use of force dashboard has launched yet.
Yeah.
There is one that's been in the works, but the stats are kept. We keep them. There's the monthly report. There's an annual report that gets created, and then there's a dashboard that's been in the works. The problem with the dashboard that we've run into, that we're trying to iron everything out, is everything that's put in is put in by humans, so sometimes there's some error with how things are classified and stuff, so we're still working that out and just correcting any of those. But then I don't know what the final... It hasn't been released yet. We've seen betas of it. And then that same use of force dashboard will exist in a different method for the commanders of the divisions, so instead of getting a report monthly, they'll be able to see live use of force data for their division.
There are other agencies that define the same types and examples, so you can compare one agency to another, like type 2, type 3.
There are. I recently saw MESAs. MESA basically modeled theirs after ours. It did it the opposite. So they have 4-3-2-1, where 4 being like our type 0, and then 1 being a deadly use of force. When this use of force, when our policy was developed, and it's constantly evolving, there was a lot that was looked at as far as the Police Executive Research Forum, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, their models. It's really easy. You can always go look at an agency that's under a consent decree currently and look at how they had to change their policies to meet federal guidelines, and then you can model your policies after theirs because you know that it meets the federal guidelines, the federal recommendations. So there was a lot that was researched when this use of force policy was developed. And as I said, it's constantly evolving and changing as anything else that changes.
Locally, are they all the same? Like Sheriff's Department?
Similar. I know, like, for example, and I probably shouldn't say this on the record because I don't know what their newest one is, but when I was a firearm sergeant, our agency was a little bit more restrictive on the use of the taser versus other agencies. Some other agencies were still allowing the use of a taser for defensive resistance, where we will only use it for act of aggression. The difference of that being defensive resistance is somebody taking actions to avoid being detained, running, or just trying to pull away from the officer, but not in a way that's trying to injure the officer. Act of aggression is assaultive acts taken against the officer. So rather than me pulling away, me taking a swing at the officer. Some of the other agencies were a little bit looser with that one than ours is. As far as the others go, I haven't compared with them to be able to speak to that specifically.
If the defense hasn't stepped in, like the FBI require a certain shared definition.
No, and we're currently, next week, we have our accreditation from the Arizona Law Enforcement Accreditation Program. We have our final assessment with them there, so they will also be reviewing our use of force policy and our use of force investigation policy, and we have to meet their guidelines also to become accredited. So, cash flow's not up yet.
Accreditation is
It's a long, arduous process.
We do it for that.
That's cool. Any other questions?
No, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Very informative. Okay, item number 4, CPARB concerns presented by Stephen Moore.
Thank you. Really appreciate the board allowing me to speak, and I guess more importantly, to get feedback from the board instead of having a one-way dialogue. Ms. Cannon, it sounds like you have the potential to get a lot of calls during the night. just wondering. So, you know, the handout was distributed by the clerk's office. Thank you. And I just wanted to, I don't know if you've read it. I'm trying to read it. It sense. Being an accountant, I'm not always the best communicator. I'm not that good with words sometimes. So I don't know if those of you have read it, maybe tell me what you got from it.
Definitely have questions.
Okay.
And thoughts.
All right.
For sure. So, yes, I did read it. And after reading and after months and months and months of you presenting this stuff, it feels that you want CPARB to be something that it cannot be. And that's a feeling. And I took a look at, I printed out the policy and procedure of CPARB that outlines the who's and what's and how's of this board, and given your input about what you think CPARB should be doing, it seems to be a huge conflict in that you're asking CPARB to do something that's beyond the policy and procedure. So definitely appreciate suggestions, but it seems like we're severely limited into what we can do. And what we can do is what we've been doing. So I imagine there's a way to make an amendment to the policy procedures, but I can't imagine it would be up to us to initiate that change. So if you want CPARB to be different, encourage you to initiate whatever change to whatever city and council member to initiate that change.
Are you looking at modifying or amending ordinance? Mm-hmm. Policy and procedures are going to talk about how you can work within the ordinance provided. So it's the ordinance, I think, is what you're doing.
So the ordinance, yeah. So I imagine there's a thought-out process to get that done. So that's my initial thought. It seems like you want us to do something that we just cannot do.
I guess, thank you, I appreciate that. I understand where you're coming from. I guess it all depends on one's interpretation of the policy as it's written or as the ordinance is written. I think Article 8? I think it's written quite broadly so that CPARB can do just about anything they want to with few exceptions, one of them being, actually doing an investigation. So what I'm talking about is instead of just reviewing complaints by citizens, reviewing some other things, such as the one that I mentioned in the handout as far as the pursuit of PPD's policies of pursuit. I think reviewing PPD's policy is well within Article 8. But I guess the point I really wanted to get across is that CPARC is unique. CPARC is different than any other organization. CPARC is supposedly, the way it's set up, in my mind, it frees a lot of bias that other boards have, or that other boards could have. And just to have CPARC just focusing on, like CPARC has, basically, lower level uses of force, not very often use of force, but sometimes. Lack of service seems to be a popular one. Another popular one that seems to be rudeness. I just think CPARC, the way it's set up, the way it's structured, the way you're appointed by council members, there's just so much potential there for CPARC. Now, I guess the question is, okay, am I being too generous or too, as far as my interpretation is concerned, am I stretching the board of the interpretation? Certainly we can get some clarification, but it's just to me that CPARC is just so important, and it just set up that it's an ideal organization and it should be looking at things that generate more, more community concern.
So I appreciate that that comment, and I am reviewing the cases every month, and I can tell you from my selection, it is not the same selection each time. And as someone who's not a member of CPARC, that doesn't have access to the body-worn camera, does not have access to all of the details, there's a lot that you're missing that we are reviewing and we're voting on. And specifically, you're concerned about how we are voting on the fair and thoroughness of the cases. Not only are these cases very diverse, and there's different categories from which they fall in, with the exception of the severe use of force, item 4 use of force. We don't review those, but there is one case in particular today that we're reviewing that does include use of force. So I think that that's information that you don't have, and that some of our CPARC advisory members, like Carlos, doesn't have that information. And as CPARC board, we're voting on those.
I think one of the things, you know, last month I passed out a handout. And one of the things that I mentioned in the handout, there were 4 goals for CPARC. Started off trivial, working on what I thought was the most important, which is having CPARC review more items that would create community concern or controversy that probably perhaps solve those. The third item was having the material that's reviewed by CPARC posted. I wrote an email to, who was it, Mr. Barone? I haven't heard back from him. I should have followed up on it sooner. Haven't done that. But to me, it seems like it'd be easy for that material to be posted online somewhere. And that way, somebody who wanted to find out more information about what you're discussing, and I think I mentioned it last week, sometimes it's kind of, you know, we don't know, when I say we, people like I'm listening to the recording don't know all what's involved. So I think that would be very beneficial to have that available to the public.
Well, that's something that we can certainly look into. Right now, TPD is spending hours redacting a lot of the information that we are reviewing just for security reasons. So I think that that would have to go above and beyond to have that available to the general public. But that's something that we can talk to our city attorney about.
And I think it's part of the process, too, because it is sort of randomized, right? We're given a large list of cases that have been reviewed by OPS, and we don't have a whole lot of information of what's in them. So it's a real luck of the draw. And yes, there, you know, a lot of them have to do with behavior, but that, I think that falls within the category of what CPARC is responsible for doing. I'm looking at the items that you sort of identify really related to, like, the border patrol and the pursuit thing, and I don't think we've ever really seen how the case today was someone complaining about poor driving. But we, you know, so it's a random process, and I think you're right. I think because of the labor that goes into redacting that is something that, I don't know if we could look into that, but I think the reality is the time and that it takes to look at all those cases that come through. We don't get a lot of information. We don't need a lot of information. But we're also here as part of the voice of the community. So to some extent, that's our responsibility, is that we're representing the community to the best that we can. So, you know, hearing more from folks from the community coming directly to us or providing the information is part of the process that CPAR can do, you know, connecting with the community in some ways. But, yeah, I think a lot of it is our hands are kind of held with how the procedures are sort of set up.
Okay. Well, thank you. I know what I need to do next, so I appreciate that.
Stephen, have you considered being on the advisory board? Have you considered being part of CPAR?
I am. When I thought CPAR was going under because of the law that was passed in Phoenix stating that you have to have so many hours of education, I thought that perhaps would be a good time for me to jump on board to, simply because I afraid CPAR would go under. But Tucson Police Department stepped up and they came up with a training that was required. I know Ms. Nunez was heavily involved in getting everybody through the training. Of course, Mr. Kagan was also heavily involved in getting everybody to the training. And here we have CPAR. I expressed something. I didn't think it was going to happen, to be honest with you. I thought CPAR was going to be dead. But it's,
I'm still looking, though. We're still looking, so.
But the thing about being on the board, you're going to be on board 8 years. I've been around a little longer than 8 years.
Only 8 years.
Sorry. And then, yeah, but again, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you letting me know what you think the issue is. Again, from my interpretation of reading the same material, I read it that it's wide open as opposed to just looking at complaints by citizens. So that's something that I know what I need to do next. So I really appreciate it. It's very valuable. So thank you all.
Well, we appreciate your passion and attending these meetings and your feedback. I think it's very important for us as the advisory board and for TPD as well to be working together. There's some information that you don't have. You come on this side of the table, you'll have that information. So some of your questions can be answered.
Okay,
thank you very much. So at this time, we'll go to item number 5, which is the report from the chairperson. I just want to mention that I appreciate all of the dedication from Tucson Police Department. We wrapped up the gem show, and I know that there were a lot of resources that were used to make sure these 40-some-odd gem shows were taken care of and they were protected, and hosting 2 gem shows where I work. I know that the show promoters were very grateful, so thank you very much to TPD and all of their efforts these last few weeks. I know it was quite a strain on resources. So item number 6, call to the audience. At this time, the community may address the board with their concerns. The board may not address the specific concern at this meeting. However, the board may, at its discretion, make a future agenda item at which time there can be a discussion. Community members are also asked to address the board, not specific board member. Each person is limited to 3 minutes. Do we have anyone interested? Okay. Perfect. Let's go on to item number 7, the review of the TPD investigations. And in accordance with section 10A-88F of the Mayor Council mandate, the board may only review those terms specific in the investigation in order to make comments on the fairness and thoroughness of the internal investigation and to report any concerns regarding the investigation to those specified in the mandate. So case number one is case number 22-0381. And this occurred Operation Division West on September 22nd, 2022. Allegations of unprofessionalism and expectations toward the public and failure to take action. There was an anonymous complaint that gave YouTube video detained, let go, arrested, and released September 26, 2022, part 1. By Pigs Under Pressure. And I cannot find that YouTube video. I didn't look very hard. Okay.
Nothing to say.
I don't either. Familiar individual that was a part of the being detained from previous years of CPAR meetings. And it seems that the review was done carefully and information there. Although I will say, you know, not all the flooding warning camera was there in the case file until
yesterday.
Yes,
today. But there were a few that were uploaded today.
Yeah, so I don't know. I needed more angles of the incident or whatever the case is, so sitting on the fence on this one. Other than what was written, I mean, I think the writing was clear.
I think that the documentation was clear, and I think it was thorough. I understand it took a while for them to upload the redacted by one camera video. I do have one question, because the incident is with regards to somebody in the public taking a video of police officers while they're doing an investigation on the case. Is there an administrative directive on how to handle these situations? At one point, I thought that there was supposed to be a perimeter for the general public approaching officers and other people who were involved in the investigation of the case that was going on. Can someone answer
that? I can speak to that a little bit. So you are correct. If there's a criminal investigation and a scene has been determined, then you can limit access to what that scene is. You may see that, we'll use an example of a homicide scene where you stick a crime scene tape up. You can create a physical boundary for a criminal investigation. Now, in this particular case, this was an ongoing investigation, but it happened to be a little bit unique in that the location where the officers were was right along a sidewalk, which is public, but it's also an apartment on private property where someone had lost their life, and a family was dealing with the suffering going on there. So that was largely where the legal question came of, were we investigating a criminal incident? At the time, it was identified as possibly not being criminal in nature, but we were also dealing with a person being on a public sidewalk. It just happened to be the design of this apartment. Had it been one apartment on the other side, we wouldn't have had, I don't think, the same issue of the filming and the engagement of the officers. And we were also trying to be respectful of the family who had lost a loved one, but also knowing what her limitations were. So in those cases, it can be. The other one that's a little bit different would be a civil case, let's say civil traffic. It's not a criminal investigation, it's civil in nature. But an officer can create their own little boundary as far as safety concerns. Like, I would never let someone walk up and, you know, behind me if I'm looking into a car dealing with a person. But if they're on a public sidewalk and I can see them 5 feet away from me, I have to be cognizant that it's a civil investigation that I'm working on, so I can't technically create that boundary unless there's a safety concern that's being formulated there. Question?
Sorry. Yeah, it would fall under our constitutional law, general orders, and whether someone has a right to be in a place and whether we have a crime scene to protect. That crime scene can be really big in the beginning and then shrink, or it can be small and made bigger. It just depends on how it goes.
So if you have a crime scene and you have a tape up, use yours as an example, and you have people on the other side of the line, are they allowed to take footage, or are they allowed? So here's another extreme, because I've never seen it happen, but I've seen them. The suckers that float fly all over the drones, can they use, can that, do you have any way to stop that?
To answer your question, if a crime scene has been designated,
yes.
As long as the person is in a lawful position, so the other side of the crime scene tape, some people have telescopic lenses and other people have their cell phone. So, yes, as long as they're in a totally permissible place, then they can do that. The drone footage is a little bit different depending on what the crime is and the jurisdiction that, I mean, it gets tricky when it comes into personal space being elevated, right? Like over a federal building versus over a city building, or there's also restrictions of just drones because the ability for one to crash So there's limitations on where those can be, but there are some specifics that deal not just with the drone, but it's more the air from where they're access. Yes, sir.
Okay. I can tell you because I operate a drone. You're not allowed to fly a drone over people without a permit for that specific event. So in that case, if you have officers working in a crime scene and somebody's flying the drone over officers in said crime scene, they're not allowed to do that.
Okay.
Thank you. But there is a city ADM, right?
Is that an FAA rule?
No, not on the drone, but on the taking video.
And when you say AD, are you talking about is there a policy for the Tucson Police Department on how we can handle it? There's state law that restricts criminal access to a crime scene.
I thought Mayor Council...
Mayor Council had passed one, and then they reversed it.
Yes.
So there was a city ordinance.
We can't use that.
Yeah. We don't use the state. Our legal advisors read the state law that was passed, and we don't use that state law. We don't enforce that state law.
Okay.
So much more liberal interpretation.
Of the state law?
Permitting. Recording. Cool.
We're erring on the side of the First Amendment, yes.
We don't feel that we would be as a city in a defensible position were we to follow the state law. I don't know if the city attorney has any other...
I don't have any insight on that just because it's not my bailiwick, but what you're saying makes sense.
That's
we interpret it more broadly than the state law, so we're not as prescriptive.
2 years ago, the city crafted a policy to limit access by these auditors, and that policy lasted maybe one meeting, and I think it was revisited and pulled out of concern for violating
rights.
Well, thank you. Would either one of you like to... comment on the fair and thoroughness of this investigation?
Well, I feel like making a motion.
Okay.
I move to find item 22-0381 to be found fair and thorough.
I'll second that.
Thank you.
Annabelle Williams?
Aye.
Amy Calvin?
Aye.
And Martha Lynn?
Aye. Perfect. So let's move on to case number 22-0480, which occurred December 15th, 2022. This was Operation Midtown, and the allegations of a misdemeanor. The complainant alleged that officers had taken $650 from their wallet, their personal wallet. Looks like there was quite a bit of investigation that actually went back to bank statements, withdrawals, etc. There was investigation that went back to the bank statements and withdrawals from the complainant.
Mm-hmm. I think it was really well investigated. I think it was very thorough.
I concur. Would you like to?
Yeah, sure. I'll make a motion that case 22-0480 was found to be fair and thorough.
Second.
Annabelle Nunez?
Aye.
Kate Calhoun?
Aye.
And Martha Lund?
Aye. All right, terrific. Case number 23-0096. This occurred Operations Division South. There was a complaint that was made online with regards to an officer driving recklessly, and the complaint requested that the officer be spoken to about their driving behavior and possibly receive additional training.
Did complainant ever define recklessly?
Yes, the complaint did.
There was a description of the actions. Lane changes without using a turn signal, cutting people off.
They said they had to brake and that they estimated their speed to be 11 miles over the speed limit.
estimated.
Pretty good.
Okay, I forget the detail. Complainant was a person in the vehicle at the time or a passerby?
Was someone else driving on the roadway.
Ah, okay.
They claimed that the officer cut them off. They had to apply their brakes to avoid a collision, that he was driving recklessly and speeding.
I think that the investigative piece was good because they couldn't get a lot of information out of the individual in terms of, like, did you see the person? So it was really filling in the gaps of trying to determine, like, could you identify who it was? So the investigative work was finding out who was driving that vehicle at that time, et cetera. So I thought it was really well investigated also. In the conversation with the officer, there was some verbal counseling.
That's correct.
And the person was receptive.
Very receptive. So I can actually speak to this because this is my case. The officer is my lead police officer. He's a tenured veteran of the police department. I believe he's got 26 years on now. He did not remember the incident at all, but he didn't argue. He didn't try and make any sort of excuses or defenses for why he may have been driving like that. If I remember right, his words were something along the lines of, if they said I was driving like that, I can't argue with it because I don't remember. So when I counseled him about appropriate driving behaviors, especially when according to your unit history, you're not en route to an emergency situation, you have to be very cognizant of the way you're driving affects the public and the danger you're putting the public in. Very receptive to that and haven't had issues since.
So I don't know would be that case number 23-0096 was. Ms. Farrington.
I second.
Annabelle Nunez.
Hi.
Kate Calhoun.
Hi.
And Martha Munn.
Hi. Item number 10, Tucson Police Department, in accordance with the provisions of the open public meeting law, these items are listed on the agenda in order to allow TPD to present a brief summary of current events. Pursuant to provisions ARS section 38-431.02, the board may not propose, discuss, deliberate, or take action at this meeting on any matter in the update unless specific matter is properly noticed for legal action at a subsequent meeting.
Sammy?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Hey, Captain, it's lawyers.
All right, just, they wanted me to mention the PSI program, Public Safety Investigator. We've got 17 that are out of the academy and are out in field training, and they'll be joining our investigative units once they're through all their training and kind of taking on a role of assisting detectives and helping us in some short areas. Pretty excited about that and see how that works out. And then P&I. Has the board been explaining P&I before? I was told that you had a little bit of an update on that, Place Network Investigations. We have a P&I board March 14th at 1330 at the Miracle Mile substation. We will have another monthly P&I meeting. And at that meeting, they may be discussing the next location that they're going to choose. So it would be a good opportunity for you to come and see how we identify violent crime areas and determine how we're going to work with other city organizations, nonprofits, and private parties to address violent crime.
And that will be posted on the city website?
It will not be posted on the city website.
Okay, so it's not open to the general public?
The general public can show up if they want to watch it, but it's not a... an open public meeting.
Okay.
It's a P&I board that the city manager's office runs.
Okay, and that's on, you said March 13th?
March
14th.
I'm going to give you an insight into one of the things that we're using for crime reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Part of our plan of tactical investigator model, POP checkouts, and P&I, our violence reduction team that's getting ready to go into place and part of our overall strategy. So I don't know if that's all I've explained to you, but this meeting would be a good opportunity for you to show up and see what they're doing.
Thank you.
That was all I have.
March 14.
Okay, and Office of OPS. So, as I kind of discussed at the use of force, we are, our office is the office that also oversees the accreditation that we're working on. So we have that coming up. Our site visits at the 28th and 29th. Then the assessors meet some time after being here to put everything together to determine if we met the accreditation or not. So we know about a month after that, hopefully. So probably not in time for the March meeting, but hopefully we'll have some news by the April meeting on that. A new captain has been identified, Captain James Wakefield. I think you have all seen him as he's come here. He's currently at the East Side Patrol Division. He'll be moving to OPS on February 25th, and he'll be effective. So then he should be at the next March meeting to introduce himself formally. But now we don't have any updates on the OPS side.
Thank you. Item number 9, Office of the Independent Police Officer.
All right, I continue with reviews, and I'm still almost daily receiving referrals from Mayor of Council, as they might be at the same time. One was a Ward 3, Ward 3. Who's Ward 3? That was a case where Council 8 had some concerns about the way one of their constituents was treated, question about excessive force, and whether or not police had grounds for detaining and they were fighting. The case had been investigated years ago by OPS, and I sat through the interview and the concluding interview with Mr. Plant last year, I believe. And everything was explained as clear as a bell to the person who initially thought he was abused. Body worn camera showed zero issues. And somehow or other, that individual may have forgotten. And it was all explained to him previously, and reached out to Council 8. He said, "Hey, I was over here." And I don't think he was playing the Council 8, quite frankly. I think there may be some kind of cognitive deficiency. At least I hope that's the case. And sat down with the OPS investigating sergeant and myself and that Council 8. We reviewed the entire body worn camera available for questions and answers. OPS went on their way to really accommodate council's request. So, I did that. I taught at the police academy that Captain Peterson referred to for the professional staff, and these are assistants to detect me. Is that kind of an easy thing?
They're civilian investigators, so they'll have the same role as a detective. They just won't have any police authority, so they can't arrest anybody. We can't swear out a warrant, but otherwise they can conduct investigations, interviews, review evidence, process a crime scene.
They are not kids like you would, and that's, I know that's relative. I'm probably the oldest one in the room. So they're more established adults than you see for CSOs or basic recruits. They were very engaging in the group that I spoke to, very bright. Very excited. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with those folks. They have no weapons. They're not trained in use of any weapons. Very minimal self-defense is offered to those folks in their academy. And
it's on the PSI, right?
Yes, and they also do not have any union representation, which I don't understand that very frankly. At least I'm hoping something like that changes. Yeah, that's pretty scary.
I think he can answer that.
So actually, they do have union representation, but they fall under the CWA union, not the Tucson Police Officers Association union. So the same union that represents PAMA has them for the time being.
They didn't tell me that.
CWA stands for
Communication and Kitchen Services?
At the time. Was that during the academy?
Yeah.
Then at the time, they may not have known that, but there was some,
okay.
Some debate over who would be able to represent them in their official legal definition of their job description.
I think involved in something law enforcement related. Your CWA rep is not going to be as familiar, I think, with how to protect them as you find probably in the TPOA.
What are examples of some of the things that the departments are looking to engage them in that will help?
So I'll have two of them assigned to Operations Division South. They'll be in our neighborhood crime section, and they'll be assigned cases like any other detective. So when an officer goes and takes like a burglary report and they collect DNA evidence or fingerprints, they write a case report that gets submitted. It goes to the neighborhood crime sergeant who reviews that case and decides whether or not they're going to assign it to a detective. It could be assigned to a PSI instead, and then that PSI would then submit evidentiary items for forensics. I want this DNA process, fingerprints process. They would follow up with any video review, see if there's any other leads to follow up on, further interviews that are required. And they'll actually build the case and present it to the county attorney. If they think they have enough, they'll present the county attorney and decide if that case is going to be accepted. Go to grand jury. They just won't go out and put handcuffs on.
Oh, great.
And they're non-uniform.
Sure.
They were a thick black shirt with a TPD logo, maybe. Follow some type of identification. They should badges on them.
They do have a badge, yes.
So it's, you know, it's another way to use people that, without having to take commissioned officers away from more serious.
Sure.
That requires something to be able to fire them other tools. I think it's a good group of them.
Cool.
Just the same comes from that. And then you mentioned the junction, so I have to share a happy story. I've had a lot, so indulge me. I got a phone call from the mayor's office saying this guy is very upset at the police department. He's reached out to us and he doesn't feel like he's getting proper police service. So I spoke with him. How about the gem show he's been going for years, and he sets up these booths over the African village and he sells knives. I think his cheapest is $1,500.
Oh.
And he forges them himself and he makes a dinosaur bone handles and nice stuff. And last year, and again, since he has such high dollar items, he set up a surveillance camera. Last year, I caught somebody stealing $1,500. Couldn't do anything with it. He made a report. And then this year, he came in the same spot, set up his booth, and he put up posters of the fellow who stole from him. So, warning other vendors, this guy's a thief. Watch out for him. And if you know anything about it, let us know. And sure enough, the fellow walked up to the knife vendor, and said, I know that guy. He used to work for me. I know his name. I know where he lives. I know him to be a thief and he's a hoarder. Here's all the information. Now, Mr. Knife Guy is thrilled. He says, wow, I've got TPD. And he called in the report, the update the report, and he said, oh, yeah. And, go get him 3 days during the gym show. And these resources are spread thin as it is. And now officers are out working the gym show. They're even listening. So we made some phone calls. And as it turns out, Captain Peterson is involved in this. You've got 1 year to arrest for a misdemeanor. And even though its value is greater, bring it to a felony, you wouldn't have gotten a felony. The best that was ever going to happen was misdemeanor. And he had reported it. Again, Jim shows pretty standard dates, right? Captain Peterson sent down some staff. The guy was cited at 10:30, and it was going to expire at midnight.
Oh,
man.
So it was pretty amazing.
Yeah, did you know that when you sent them out?
We knew we had talked to the legal advisor, and they said Columbus, he was arrested by midnight.
10:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Right.
So, you make a few phone calls to get the right people, things to happen. It certainly kept doing this. was one of the main people. And it worked out really well. And the guy was like, Mitch, can I buy you lunch? I said, but do me a favor. And I said, you've been walking around the last few days complaining about how TPD isn't doing their job. And again, realistically, they weren't going to jump on that, I'm sure. But I said, do me a favor. What you can do now is go out and be an ambassador for after with the service that you just got. So you should go out there and say some nice things.
That's huge.
And share with the other vendors and anybody else you may be complaining to previously about the service you got from TPD. That charge is pending at Tucson City Court at present, and you're considering bringing it to the county attorney for the next charge as well. So the fellow knows he's likely not going to make enough back. As he told me, he can care less at this point. He just wants justice. And the fact that the wheels turned the way they did and it worked out the way that it did at 10:30, an hour and a half,
weeks out sometimes,
is really remarkable. So, well, you don't often hear good stories.
Yeah.
And so I felt compelled.
That's true.
Cool.
That's what I
did. Congratulations.
Good job.
That might be.
And of course.
You.
Without a doubt.
All right. So item number 10, CPAR vacancies. We have a couple.
Yep. Do we have an update on the mayor's appointee?
Mayor is hi, Mary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Honey is signed, sealed, delivered, I believe.
Did you just word in?
Oh, great.
I believe I can check.
I
know he was in appointment. We got
yes,
the document.
Yes.
I texted him earlier. I haven't heard from him. At any rate, Ward 1, I know somebody that works for Ward 1 and applies. He said, I'm very interested in CPAR. Please consider me. And they never heard that. So that's
not really. And you're not hearing back from Ward 1 specifically or from the individual?
More
than one. So we can go ahead and appoint that individual, correct?
No. You can get the mayor and council
to appoint.
Okay. So do...
If after, I believe it's 30 days, that the ward doesn't appoint an open position to one of the boards or commissions, I think the rest of the city council can go ahead and do that. I believe it's 30 days. I'm not sure. It's been talking years at this point.
And Heine has not done his own.
Yeah, for 30 years. He's received the memo, but he just hasn't.
He's not done his own. Okay. Okay. And he can, if he doesn't have his oath completed by next meeting, he's not allowed to vote. Correct?
What's that?
That's Heine has not done. So he can't vote, correct?
No.
His oath is not
his
oath is not in.
I think it's really before the meeting. It takes 30 seconds.
Okay, well, there you go.
Okay.
Okay,
great.
I can reach out again. Just to see what you're doing virtually, but not.
And the hope, of course, is not voting on either number 14. Will be considered by either Ward 1 or Ward 2, but to fill the slot just until he completes the training.
I'll be happy to make those calls.
Mm-hmm. I started on my work.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe we can talk offline.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Item number 11, future agenda items. I think we need to officially vote for a chairperson. Just saying.
That's item
12. Elections. Oh, okay. So, excuse me. Continue to read. All right. Future agenda items. I can't think of anything at the moment. Okay. We will move to item number 12, CPAR elections. If I can only read.
I'd like to nominate Kate.
Okay. The chairperson should be one
to the
chair 2 years.
You've got the paperwork?
Yes.
I'm not the organizer. Thank you, Steve.
And go for 2 years? Okay.
Yes, I think each term of each elected officer shall be 1 year renewed. At least that's the old, that's your old form.
Oh,
I
know that. Yes, okay.
Do I have to call for three nominations?
Yes. Annabelle Nunez?
Oh. Aye. No, she accepted. So we have to make a motion. So I move that we accept Kate's acceptance to take the chairperson position again.
Yeah.
Second.
Yay.
And Annabelle Nunez?
Aye.
Martha Lennon?
Aye.
Kevin Calhoun?
Aye.
I'm not going to name myself to be vice chair.
You can't listen for yourself. You can nominate yourself.
I'm stuck in that.
I thought you were something.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know what you're asking.
Okay, so Annabelle, you will accept our recommendation to be vice chair?
Yes.
Annabelle Nunez?
Aye.
Kate Calhoun?
Aye.
And Mark Olin?
Aye.
Okay.
Great. Item 13. Before we adjourn, our next meeting is March 19th. And item number 13. Yes.
Any future training considerations? Lieutenant, did you want to train anything else?
Are you volunteering me to train more stuff?
Does the chair any interest in any little training opportunities?
We're always interested.
Yeah. Has anything previously been discussed, Ray?
I can't remember what else comments.
Okay. We have the theory of the issue.
So if there's something, if you want it covered, we can do a presentation that would encompass T&I on our violence reduction strategy.
That'd be terrific.
So that you get kind of all the aspects of it and what's being done.
Cool. Yeah.
As for future item agendas?
Yes.
So you know I'm PMA?
Yes.
Okay.
Specifically for next month?
Well, just so that we can...
You tell me when
that would you be want it. Would you be available to do it next month? I mean, you've got just a couple, like a week turnaround.
No, I won't be available, but I can definitely delegate that to somebody who will be available.
He's got...
Midtown is ready to step in, so...
Okay.
So for March, if not April, we'll kind of see where you guys are at with that.
So March for P&I. Please.
Captain Carlson will be glad to help.
Okay.
Are
you
ready?
Go ahead.
Oh, my God.
Move to adjourn. Thank you.
Woo!
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.